Okay, well, we're approaching the problem of evil. Here's an atheistic t-shirt. It says, God works in mysterious, ineffective, and breathtakingly cruel ways. You know, as we approach this subject, the gravity of this subject is pretty strong. I mean, each one of us has opened up a newspaper, turned on the television, seen the statistics on world hunger, murder, rape, genocide, cruelty. And as we see these images, these statistics, these things that are going on around the world, there's a certain point at which you wonder, is there really a God who's in control of all this? He's got his hand on the wheel, because it really does look at times like our world is just spinning out of control. We're seeing things sometimes, images that are just so distorted and deranged and aberrant that we don't even know how to handle it sometimes. Sometimes people just deny that these things are even happening. Other people have had to embrace suffering in their own lives. And people have heard the platitudes, you know, God works in mysterious ways. His ways are higher than our ways. Okay, that is true, but we need to have a more robust worldview to handle a lot of the things going on in our world today. And that's what we hope to accomplish tonight, is to understand the problem of evil from the Christian worldview. Well, before we do that, before we launch into the Christian's view of the problem of evil, instead of going on defense, what we should actually do is begin by going on offense, pointing out the fact that the problem of evil is not just a problem for Christians. It's actually a problem for everybody. It's not as though when you abandon God, you no longer have a problem with evil and suffering in the world. No, instead, all worldviews have to give an account, have to give an explanation for evil, and have to explain how you survive, how you persevere under evil and suffering. When we turn from Christianity to atheism, we find that atheism doesn't just have one problem with evil. Instead, they have three different problems with evil. They have the problem of defining evil. They have the problem of defeating evil. And they have the problem of dealing with evil. The three D's. The triple threat. Well, let's get started with that first problem for atheism. Defining evil. Atheism has a difficulty even defining what evil is. So when we talk about the problem of evil with someone who doesn't believe that there's a God, we should first begin by asking, how do you define evil in the absence of God? You know, for a naturalist, someone who believes that all that there is in this world is nature and nothing beyond it, okay? To be a naturalist means that there is no such thing as a supernatural existence. There's nothing beyond nature or above nature. Everything is one and the same with nature. Well, if everything in nature is natural, then how can you ever look at one part of the world and call it unnatural? You know, we've got a picture here of a lion chasing a gazelle. I know how this story ends. The lion is faster than the gazelle. Jumps on him, rips its jugular out, blood flies everywhere. You know, can we really call that action evil? No. We would just call that nature. That's what happens in the natural order. In nature, the fast eat and the slow starve. Sorry to break the news. That's just the way it is. It's not the way it ought to be. It's just the way that it is in nature. You know, we would never call this lion criminal, but we would just call him natural. That's the way it is in nature. So how is it that a naturalist can ever look at one part of the world and call it unnatural? Say that it's not good, it's actually evil. How do they define evil? Okay, the atheist doesn't have the problem of evil, but they have the problem of good. They don't know how to define good and evil from their worldview. Here's the way C.S. Lewis describes it. I think this is from Mere Christianity. He says, my argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? That's a good question. If nature is one and the same with reality, there's nothing beyond nature, then whatever you see there, there's nothing to compare it to. There's no standard that's above nature or outside of nature that you can compare it with. Whatever is in nature is the way that it is. Who is that, John Madden, who said, "It is what it is." If you're a naturalist, everything is what it is. You don't have an ought or a should be. Well, Lewis writes, if the whole universe has no meaning, we should never have found out that it has no meaning. Just as if there were no light in the universe and therefore no creature with eyes, we should never know it was dark. Dark would be a word without meaning. That's very astute. That's a very interesting observation. Here's the way Ravi Zacharias puts it. This is from his book, Can Man Live Without God? He had a questioner come up to him and ask about the problem of evil. And he asked, well, what's your worldview? And the questioner said, well, I'm an atheist. Well, he said, when you talk about the problem of evil, when you say there is evil, aren't you admitting that there is such a thing as good? When you accept the existence of goodness, you must affirm a moral law on the basis of which to differentiate between good and evil. You'd need a moral law to say one's good and the other's evil, right? But when you admit to a moral law, you must posit a moral lawgiver. There's no such thing as a law without a lawgiver. If you came up and brought a prescription to the pharmacy and you said, can you fill this prescription? And the pharmacist said, well, there's no name on the prescription. And you said, well, yeah, of course there's no name. It's just a prescription. And the pharmacist said, well, who prescribed it? Nobody prescribed it. It's just a prescription. Well, obviously, that wouldn't make any sense. But then again, we're saying there's such a thing as a moral law without a moral lawgiver. Well, he points out that, however, is who you are trying to disprove and not prove. For if there is no moral lawgiver, then there is no moral law. So atheism eliminates the problem of evil. They don't have a problem with the problem of evil only because they eliminate good. They wipe that off the radar as well. Well, that's one way of solving the problem of evil. There's a problem with that, though. It stops us from being able to have a solution to the problem. You know, think about it. If you went into the doctor and you found out that you had cancer, and the doctor said, well, that tumor is inoperable. We can't get at that tumor. However, I have a solution for killing the cancer. We'll burn you alive, and we'll definitely get at that cancer at that point. Okay, well, that is one solution for dealing with the cancer in my body. But by killing the cancer, you're going to kill me in the process. So for atheism, they do destroy the problem of evil, but by proxy, they destroy good as well. Secondly, atheism has a difficulty defeating evil. So not only defining what evil even is, but also defeating evil. Think about these three men. Pol Pot is on the left. Adolf Hitler is in the center. Joseph Stalin on the right. Between these three men, you're upwards of tens of millions of people were killed by them. What's interesting is not one of these men was brought to trial for their crimes. They came close. They tried to bring them to trial. Some of them died of natural causes. Others killed themselves before they were ever brought to trial. They never served justice for what they did. But let's just say all three of them were brought to trial. Let's say they were thrown in prison for 60 years. Would that truly make up for the atrocities that they committed in their lives? Even if they were brought to trial, could we really say that evil had been defeated in that case? I don't think so. I think that we'd have big problems still. Moreover, atheism has difficulty dealing with evil. Dealing with evil. So it's a difficulty defining evil. It's a difficulty defeating evil. And you think about somebody who crawls out of the bloodshed of genocide, you know, brutal warfare, and they crawl out of that and they ask themselves, will this ever come to an end? Atheism's response is probably not. it'll probably come to an end when the human race is wiped out. But beyond that, there's no promises. Thirdly, atheism has a difficulty dealing with evil. Years ago, I was sitting around a campfire with a young agnostic student, and he was sharing the story about how he stopped believing in God when a number of his friends died from overdose from drugs. He was in the heroin scene, real young guy, he's about 19. And he said, you know, I just can't believe in God because I've held my friends in my arms as they died of heroin overdose. And I just can't believe there's a good and loving God out there who would superintend this universe where things like that would happen. Well, as we were talking about it, and very delicately, because I knew he was grieving over these friends, I asked him this question. How has it been easier to deal with your suffering since you've stopped believing in God? He thought about it, and it was a long pause, until finally he broke down crying, and he said, it hasn't gotten any easier. And that's true. You know, it's not like when we reject God, evil and suffering becomes easier to deal with. Evil and suffering becomes less definable, even as it becomes more absurd and senseless. In other words, the solution to evil and suffering is not the rejection of God, but clinging to God during those times. And he admitted in his life that he had lost that basis for having any kind of hope in navigating these issues in his life. So those are the three basic difficulties of atheism regarding the problem of evil. I think when people bring up this subject, we should start there. I think it kind of levels the playing ground a little bit and demonstrates that, you know, if there is a God, we should hope that he would actually have answers to the evil and suffering in our lives. It's not as though when we abandon God, things start to make sense. Instead, they become more senseless and absurd. But, of course, we can point out that Christians have their problems regarding the problem of evil. And what we'll do tonight is break this subject into two separate, different kinds of arguments. The first of which are deductive arguments, and the second are inductive arguments. To put this in philosophical terms, we'll first address the logical possibility of God coexisting with evil, and then we'll move on to the evidential argument, whether evil and suffering provides good evidence that there's no such thing as a good and loving God who's all powerful. So let's get started with the deductive argument, the logical possibility that God could coexist with evil. Is the notion that God exists and evil exists logically impossible? That's a logically incoherent statement. Well, what's interesting is the majority of philosophers today, whether Christian, atheist, or agnostic, believe that deductive arguments, logical arguments for God coexisting with evil, have all proven to be false. The last famous philosopher who's argued this from the atheistic worldview is J.L. Mackey in his 1982 book, The Miracle of Theism. He's really the last major philosopher who's argued that it's impossible for God to coexist with evil. It's because of the work of Alvin Plantinga from Notre Dame in his 1977 book, God, Freedom, and Evil, that very few, if any, philosophers will argue the deductive form of the problem of evil. Well, that being said, you're probably asking yourself, well, what is a deductive argument? Let's just give a very simple deductive argument. Premise one, every dog is an animal. Premise two, Scruffy is a dog. Okay, if every dog is an animal and Scruffy is a dog, conclusion, therefore, Scruffy is an animal. If the premises are true, if premise one and premise two is true, then the conclusion follows necessarily. If premise one is true and premise two is true, the conclusion is certain, logically certain, has to be true. Well, let's consider deductive arguments that have been raised up against God possibly coexisting with evil. Here's J.L. Mackey's version of it. This is from his 1955 article, Evil and Omnipotence. He says on page 200, in its simplest form, the problem is this. God is omnipotent. Okay, we're going to be using that word a lot. We should define it. Omni means all. Potent means powerful. Okay? So omnipotent means all powerful. Omniscient is omni meaning all, science meaning knowledge, all knowing. Benevolent means loving. Omnibenevolent means all loving. Okay, that being said, God is omnipotent, all powerful. God is wholly good, and yet evil exists. How could God be all powerful and all good, and yet evil's still there? He writes, there seems to be some contradiction between these three propositions, so that if any two of them were true, the third would be false. That's an interesting way of putting it. Either God is powerful and he could destroy evil, but he's not loving, so he doesn't want to. Or God's loving and he wants to destroy evil, but he's impotent, he's not powerful enough to do it. Or there's just no such thing as evil. That's the view of Christian Science and other pantheistic worldviews, that evil's just an illusion. Well, I don't think that's a possibility either. I mean, if evil is an illusion, then why is it such a strong illusion? If evil's an illusion, then why do we even have that illusion? Wouldn't the illusion of evil be an evil? I don't think that's a possibility. So we're stuck with God being all-powerful and all-loving. Well, Mackey writes, but at the same time, all three are essential parts of most theological positions. He's right. I mean, when you read your Bible, you can't exclude any one of those three. The theologian, Mackey writes, it seems, at once must adhere and cannot consistently adhere to all three. Here's the way Epicurus writes about it. At least this quote is often attributed to him, whether he said it or not. Going back into ancient Greece, he said, is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Then he's not omnipotent. Is he able but not willing? Then he's malevolent. He's evil. Is he both able and willing? Then why is there evil? Is he neither able nor willing? Then why call him God? Some philosophers refer to this as the omni-triad, a triangle like this, that there would be an all-powerful God, an all-good God, and yet evil exists. There seems to be a logical problem with those three things coexisting at once. Well, that's the question we have to answer. Is there a logical problem? Is this internally incoherent, not consistent, to say this? Is it logically possible that God could coexist with evil? Well, I'd like to give you a few separate formulations, and I would actually like to solve these together. I'd like to hear your thoughts. Formulation number one. Premise one, God is the author of everything. Premise two, evil is something. Conclusion, therefore, God is the author of evil. Now, that's a logically coherent deductive argument. That makes logical sense. If premise one is true and premise two is true, the conclusion follows by necessity. This would be showing that it's logically impossible for God to exist with evil. Well, let's kick this out to the group. Let's hear some thoughts. Which premise would you go after? Which one would you point out? And then why would you say that that's not true? Let's start up here. That's good. That's a good point. Actually, I had that myself. I went after premise two as well. He's saying that evil is not something. It's the privation. It's the distortion of something. So evil is not a substance. It's not like there's something that is evil. Evil is the privation or the distortion of something that's real. Think about it like a parasite. A parasite cannot live without a host. Evil cannot exist on its own, only as it attaches on to something that's actually good. Okay, could we have 100% completely moldy bread? No, that would no longer be moldy bread. That would just be mold. Okay. Could we have a 100% completely rusted car? No, that would just be a brown spot on the pavement. What about a moth-eaten garment? Completely moth-eaten. No, that would be what we call a hanger, okay? That's no longer a garment. So we have to have a standard for something in order to have evil. So evil is not a real thing. It's the privation of a real thing. Let's look at formulation number two. God made everything perfect, premise one. Imperfection cannot come from perfection, premise two. Perfectly created beings cannot be the origin of evil, premise three. Therefore, God must be the origin of evil, conclusion. It's a deductive argument. If those three premises are true, the conclusion follows by necessity. So which premise would you go after here in this argument? Okay. Okay. Okay, that's good. So God could have created them perfect, and yet they freely willed to be not good. I went over after premise three also. I thought that was the one to take down. Okay, did God create the first humans perfect? I think so. Yes, he did. Perfectly created beings cannot be the origin of evil. Yes, they are the origin of evil. God created perfect beings with free will. And free will, if we say God shouldn't have created people with free will, then we're contradicting ourselves because we're using free will to say we shouldn't need free will. Well, the critic will come back at this point and say, well, how is it possible that they could have chosen something that was evil if God created everything to be perfect and good? Well, actually, the first free-willed agent to rebel against God was not the first humans. It was Satan, a spiritual being. And we could explain it this way. It's that Satan willed a lesser good himself over a greater good, God. So it's not like he picked something that was evil from a perfectly created universe. Instead, he raised himself up over a greater good, which is imperfect. That's a sinful decision. Okay, here's the way Norman Geisler puts it. This is from his book, When Skeptics Ask. This is a really clever way of describing it. God is not responsible for evil. God created the fact of freedom. We perform the acts of freedom. That's something you should remember. God created the fact of freedom. We perform the acts of freedom. He made evil possible. Men made evil actual. Imperfection came through the abuse of our moral perfection as free creatures. Good way of putting it. Okay, formulation number three. Premise one, if God is all good, he would destroy evil. If God is all powerful, he could destroy evil. Evil is not destroyed, hence there is no such God. Which premise one or two would you go after? Yeah. Okay. I see what you're saying, but I don't think destroying evil is an evil action. I think that's a good thing. Like if a SWAT team sniper took down a hostage holder, I think that would be a good decision. I can't think of the word. Yeah. Well, in the end, God will destroy evil. We know that. So we'd have to say that it is morally permissible. God has the right to judge. And I think that will be good. In fact, in Revelation, it says that the believers are cheering him on for his justice. Okay, what do you think, Phil? Okay. Okay, that we're going to get to that later. That's a great point. Premise three, we could say, we could just add one word to solve this argument. Evil is not yet destroyed. We're actually going to put this in an eschatological form to show why God will eventually destroy evil. Okay, I'm sure we have a number of thoughts. Let me just give you my spiel. I'm still trying to think of what you call a person who holds a hostage.
A criminal.
A hostage-holding person is what I call them. A kidnapper? Oh, whatever. I'll hop on Wikipedia tonight. Okay. I think both premise one and two could be taken down. Here's why. It's logically impossible to force a free-willed agent to do something. We're going to get to this later, okay? But just for now, by definition, in the very nature of having the capacity for free will, means that you can't be forced to do something. Now, is God able to override our free will? Absolutely. Of course he is. But he might not want to do that for some morally sufficient reason. He might want to not override our free will. I'm sure you've heard the illustration that God wanted persons, not primates. He wanted persons, not robots. Okay. We could point out God is in the business of defeating evil, not destroying evil. If God came through and just wiped out evil, well, that would obviously wipe out human persons as well. And God actually loves human persons, so he doesn't want to destroy that. That would be bad. But God is eventually going to defeat evil. When the dust settles, God will be victor over evil. And yet evil is not yet destroyed. Now, in order for the critic to make this claim that they know what an all-powerful, all-loving, an all-knowing being would do, they would have to be God in order to make that statement. So in order to defeat God, they'd need to be God. You know, if you were God, don't you think you would think about things differently than you do now? I mean, you think about things differently now than you did 10 years ago. And that's just from maturing, not even from gaining intelligence or anything like that. If you're God, you would probably view things differently. And if we just give one possible defeater, which is the free will defense, at that point, what we're saying is that this argument is no longer logically certain. If you can just throw in one possible objection, this argument falls to the floor. Here's the way Alvin Plantinga describes it. This is from his seminal work. This is from 1977, his book, God, Freedom, and Evil. He says the existence of God is neither precluded nor rendered improbable by the existence of evil. Now, he throws in probability because this is at the end of his book. Of course, suffering and misfortune may nonetheless constitute a problem for the theist, but the problem is not that his beliefs are logically, and he adds, or probabilistically incompatible. So he actually takes down both the logical problem and the evidential problem, but we're not on that yet. We're just strictly on the logical problem of evil. In their book, Philosophical Foundations for a Christian Worldview, William Lane Craig and J.P. Moreland write this: it is the atheist who bears the burden of proof to show that there is no possible world in which premise one and premise two are true. That is an enormously heavy burden, which has proved to be unbearable. Their point is this: can you really prove that there's no possible world where God would value free will, where that could be a potential defeater to any of these deductive arguments? And they basically said that is too big of a burden of proof to shoulder. You can't prove that. You'd have to be God in order to make that claim. Thus, they point out, after centuries of discussion, contemporary philosophers, including most atheists and agnostics, have come to recognize this fact. Most atheistic and agnostic philosophers don't argue the logical problem of evil anymore. Since 1977, when Alvin Plantinga wrote that very important book, which is a cool point. I mean, for people who say that philosophy never comes to any conclusions, not true. It definitely took on this argument, and most people agree on it at this point. It's now widely admitted that the logical problem of evil has been solved. I'm just going to pause there for any questions. Is there anything that we talked about so far that you didn't quite understand or want some more explanation or... Good. Well, that raises a good question. The question is, what about the naturalist or the atheist who just says, well, I don't believe in free will. I don't believe free will exists. Well, what's interesting to point out here is we don't have to prove that free will exists to use the free will defense on this argument. All we have to demonstrate is that, at least in this kind of an argument, a deductive argument, we just have to show that there's a possible defeater of one of the premises that are put up there. If we can show that it's even possible, an even possible defeater, then we've actually ruined their argument. Now, at that point, the naturalist will come back and say, well, come on, how do we know that we have free will? Isn't that really highly, highly unlikely that we have free will? And at that point, we would come back and say, ah, but you're admitting that it's no longer a deductive argument. Now we're moving into the evidential form, an inductive argument. Yeah. So if we're saying, if they are admitting that the free will defense will prove as a defeater, we don't have to prove that it's even true, just to show that it's possible. Because if it's possible, it shows that that argument isn't logically coherent. In his book, Alvin Plantinga gives, for the natural problem of evil, why there's suffering with viruses and with storms and tornadoes. You know, atheists will say, well, you know, it's impossible that free will could account for that. Those are natural things. How do you explain that? Plantinga comes back, and this is a Christian scholar, okay? He says, well, I think Satan could possibly be a defeater for natural evil, and all natural problems could be Satan is the one who does it. Now, at that point, the naturalist just blows their top and says, you believe in Satan, that there's an invisible, mighty spirit that's in rebellion to God? Well, prove it. And Plantinga just comes back and says, I don't have to prove it. All I have to show is that there's a possible defeater to show that your argument's incoherent. Now, if we're trying to say that there's evidence for it, we'd have to give evidence and that sort of thing. But at that point, we've moved from it being logically possible to it being probable. That's a good question, though. Yeah. That's a good question. So you're raising the question, doesn't the atheist have a difficulty differentiating between good and evil? How do they even describe evil apart from a transcendent source? Well, that's a good point. We raised that point at the beginning. But what's interesting is most atheistic philosophers will no longer refer to it as the problem of evil. They'll refer to it as the problem of suffering. They've no longer used that word. So if you pick up William Rowe's article, he's a naturalist. His argument is that he gives a case of a forest fire where a baby fawn, an innocent little Bambi fawn, is trapped in a forest fire and it burns to death. He doesn't call it evil. He just says it's needless suffering. So they've actually changed the language in order to keep the argument afloat. Because I think that would stand. It's a good question. Yeah. Well, I think the question that you're raising there is important because sometimes Christians offer platitudes. They give these kind of, you know, real pithy statements where they say things like, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger, or everything happens for a reason. Well, we can point to cases where someone goes through horrific suffering and then they end up, you know, divorcing their spouse, and then their spouse kills themselves and they kill themselves. And what was the point behind all of that? Are we saying that there is some greater point eventually? Well, we're going to address that. But just because evil occurs doesn't mean that it will necessarily bring about good. I happen to believe there is such a thing as gratuitous evil, evil that has no purpose. Biblically, the promise is God will work all things for the good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. I think that's conditional. I think there are some acts of evil that don't have a purpose. Biblically, I don't think we're committed to that. Joseph in Genesis 50, verse 20, says that when he's talking about this torture that he went through and the suffering, he says, you intended it for evil, but God intended it for good. I think that's true for that one case. I think he said that correctly, but I don't think we have the stamp that every single action is going to have a greater purpose. I don't know if that's promised to us in Scripture. And if that's the case, then gratuitous acts of evil are because we are in a fallen world and we are all sinful. And there are things that are evil because it's one sinner against another at that point. But at least from a Christian view, we have the promise that for those who love God and are committed to his purpose, God will use those things for a greater good. Okay. Well, I know what you're saying. I mean, maybe from an academic perspective, it's been solved. Maybe someone, I tried plowing through Plantinga's book. It was very, very difficult. It's logical syllogisms, and a lot of it was over my head. So it's hard to just, you know, be talking to people in a coffee shop and say, well, just read Plantinga's book, and then you can see it's been solved. I think what we have here is an example of things that maybe in academic circles haven't filtered down yet to the person on the street. But really what we see in our culture is not that people are giving logical arguments. It's more just kind of a flippant slander against God, that how could God exist if X, Y, or Z? And it's really not even given in a logical case. Most people don't think about it that way. They just think about it as, it's more an emotional problem than it is an intellectual problem. So.